Eve to the Royal Albert Hall for the first of this evening's proms. It's presented by Sarah Moore Peach.
Thanks, James. Hello and welcome to the Royal Albert Hall, which is absolutely crammed, filled to the rafters, as indeed was Hyde Park earlier on today with the swimming in the Serpentine. Well, it's a Scandinavian programme tonight. Britain is actually right now going through something of a love affair with Scandinavian culture. Crime dramas from Sweden and Denmark, cult hits on TV. We're buying lots of Scandinavian design furniture as well. Frederick Delius was actually ahead of the curve on that one. His love affair with the mountains and forests of Norway and Denmark had a big influence on his music. And tonight we've got a little-known orchestral setting by Delius at the proms, Cinera, sung by Roderick Williams. And I'm sure Delius would be happy to see it nestled in an otherwise Scandinavian programme from the BBC Philharmonic, especially with music by his friend Grieg in it. We've got the Finnish conductor, John Sturgods, tonight with the BBC Philharmonic as their principal guest conductor for the first time at the proms. Stephen Osborne joins them for a Norwegian masterpiece, the Grieg Piano Concerto. And they're also giving the UK premiere of Danish composer Pia Nørgaard's Seventh Symphony, written for the opening of a new concert hall in Copenhagen back in 2009. But we're starting and ending with a symphony by Sibelius tonight. His optimistic third will end the concert on a high note with that extraordinary final movement building to a great chaotic climax. And we'll hear tonight's conductor, John Sturgods, talking about that a little bit later on. But we're beginning with the slightly more melancholic or autumnal Sixth Symphony by Sibelius, which he wrote in 1923. It had its first performance in Helsinki. Daniel Grimley, who's the editor of a Sibelius volume and writer of the programme notes for tonight's prom, which incidentally you can see online now through the prom's website, describes the end of the Sixth Symphony as a Prospero-like gesture, Sibelius leaving his imaginary island of sounds and seeking the shadows. Sibelius himself said it reminded him of the smell of the first snow. I think that's a wonderful description. Of course, the first snow is gentle and quite fragile. You watch it falling and you don't know quite how it's going to land. And the opening has that sort of feeling about it. The applause you're hearing now is for Yuri Tuchinsky, the leader of the BBC Philharmonic. So keep that in mind, Sibelius saying that this music reminded him of the smell of the first snow. The opening really has that feeling about it with the strings and then fragile woodwinds, but the promise of something beautiful. In fact, almost all of Sibelius's music very close to the landscape of his native Finland, but this is possibly the most nature-oriented of all his symphonies. We're about to hear his sixth, performed here at the proms live on Radio 3 by the BBC Philharmonic, conducted by John Sturgods.
Thank you.
Sibelius, his sixth symphony, which Andy Jorglevich says on Twitter is sounding like the first falls of snow. This is beautiful. Live here at the Royal Albert Hall, the BBC Philharmonic, conducted by their principal guest conductor with them under that title for the first time at the BBC Proms, John Sturgards. Well, like everybody here in the Albert Hall who's about to start gossiping about what it is they just heard, you can join in the conversation about the music that we're hearing tonight at the Proms through Twitter. Just use the hashtag BBCProms and we'll pick up your message. It'd be great to hear what you think about the music. We've got more Sibelius later, his third symphony, which ends the programme. But first, music by Delius, who, although he was born in England, is not really an English composer. Florida, where he had connections with an orange plantation, France, where he spent his last years, Germany, where he studied, were all very important to him, and so was Scandinavia. He felt a great affinity with Nordic landscapes. And we're going to hear a little-known work by him called Cinara. It's a setting of a poem by Ernest Dowson, whom Delius may indeed have crossed paths with in Paris. At any rate, they were there at the same time. Dowson died in 1900. His life ended very short. Of alcoholism, he died at just the age of 32. And 7 years after his death, Delius was planning to use the poem Cinara in his cycle Songs of Sunset. But then he decided against it, and it wasn't until many years later, when Delius was old, already blind, living in France, and going through some old papers and manuscripts with his amanuensis, Eric Fenby, that the inspiration hit him again, and he decided to orchestrate it as a standalone work. We're going to hear the baritone Roderick Williams singing it, and he has just 10 minutes to take us into another world. I asked him earlier on today how he manages to establish that world in so short a space of time.
I was just thinking, we've just been rehearsing it, and in the opening minute and a half of orchestral solo, I'm right there. They put me absolutely in the place, and it's become very clear as you listen to the piece that Delius has that way of conjuring in music an incredible picture of almost a smell of where we are. And so that deals with the whole context for me. I'm right there as soon as I start opening my mouth.
And what are you singing about?
Well, it's a memory, really. It's a love poem across the ages to one's first love, this idol of the first love. And here's Ernest Dowson, this sort of decadent poet, decadent in many senses, but certainly the contemporary one. He's lying there in bed with someone that he has clearly paid money for. And while he's experiencing that and the wine that goes with it and the sense of now, his mind is always back with the first woman he ever loved. And he says, that's a mortal line, I have been faithful to thee in my own fashion. That's a line I may have to use, actually.
The baritone Roderick Williams. Well, of course, that's the line that Cole Porter adapted for his song, I'm Always True to You, Darling, in My Fashion, from Kiss Me, Kate. Well, Roderick Williams, tonight's soloist, coming on stage now with conductor John Sturgards to join the BBC Philharmonic on stage for this performance of Cinara by Frederick Delius.
Thank you. but I was desolate and sick of an old passion. When I awoke and found the dawn was grey, I have been faithful to forgot much, seen and are gone with the wind. Flung roses, roses riotously with the throng. Dancing, dancing to put thy pale lost lilies out of mind. But I was desolate and sick of an old passion, yea, all the time, because the dance was long. I have been faithful to thee, Sinara. And for stronger wine. Say.
Great applause for Roderick Williams, the baritone, who performed Delius's Cinara, incredibly tender setting of words by the poet Ernest Dowson, a decadent of his day. Roderick Williams, live here at the Proms with the BBC Philharmonic. He's being applauded by John Skurgos, tonight's conductor. And he also had a little handshake with Yuri Torchinsky, the orchestra's leader, who had such a glorious solo to begin that work. It is, of course, 150 years since Delius was born, really being celebrated this year at the Proms. Bryn Terfel, in fact, the first night of the Proms, sang Delius's Sea Drift, which is a work that Roderick Williams has also performed a great deal. And here he comes again on his own, back to the stage of the Albert Hall. Very busy man at the moment, Roderick Williams. He's now going to get in his car and drive to Cornwall, where he's singing at the St. Endelian Festival. He's singing in Tippett's Child of Our Time tomorrow night. Delius, really a composer I think he feels a great affinity with. There's more Delius still to come at the Proms this season. On Tuesday, that's the 14th, there's Paris, the Song of a Great City. He's inspired by Norwegian folk tales in his piece Eventyr, Once Upon a Time, on Monday the 20th. Tasman Little is going to play Delius's violin concerto on the 23rd of August here at the Proms, and his Songs of Farewell featuring in the last night of the Proms. But a lot of music still to go before then. And several members of the BBC Philharmonic leaving the stage now to reset for our next piece of music. In fact, they're going to wheel a piano on stage for Stephen Osborne to play the Grieg Concerto. It's one of the best known in the repertoire, and it's a really big audience favourite as well. Pianist Stephen Osborne used to be a Radio 3 New Generation artist, very favourite artist here at the Proms as well. He told me earlier on today about the creative process of working on a concerto part like this.
When the process works well, you get to a stage of feeling like you know this world that the piece is in, and that you actually don't really have to think about what you're doing, that you know you've got freedom to move around, you know what the limits are, that you could say the limits of the emotional world. And that's an amazing feeling when you get to that sort of state of freedom with a piece. But that can take years of experimentation. And particularly when you perform something a number of times, it's in performing that you get closer to that state of really knowing what the piece is about for you.
Do you feel that with the Grieg?
It's funny, actually, with the Grieg, I've not played it for 10 years, or maybe even more. So I've come to it having to kind of quite radically think about it in a different way, because my instincts for music now are completely different from what they were 10 years ago. So actually, I still feel like I'm feeling my way with it. But I gave myself a lot of time to prepare, and I've played through it for myself quite a few times, and more I feel like I'm getting to that kind of stage. Yeah. I think it's been really interesting coming back to it, because, you know, the Grieg is an incredibly popular piece, and one of the questions I had is, why is it so popular? And it feels to me that there's so many characters, so many very strong characters, strongly contrasting, and the movements, one to the other, are very, very contrasted as well. And I think part of the popularity of it is these characters are so clearly drawn. You know, there's the anguish of the opening, the romance of the second subject in the first movement, the amazing cadenza in the first movement, which has this overwhelming, dramatic and violent climax, how inward and beautiful the slow movement is, the playfulness of the last movement. And actually, one particular thing that struck me when I was looking at it is how the piece ends. You know, in the middle of the last movement, you have a very tender tune in the flute, which is somehow a bit reminiscent of the morning music from Peer Gynt, and that tune comes back in a kind of blazing sort of fanfare almost at the end, and that kind of transformation of a tune to become this incredible ending, it's such an incredibly effective gesture, and certainly didn't go unnoticed. I mean, Rachmaninoff very much took that on board for certainly the second and third concertos, and I'm sure other composers too. I mean, it's just a fantastic shape of a piece, this incredible contrast and this overwhelmingly satisfying conclusion.
That was the pianist Stephen Osborne, who's shortly going to be performing the Grieg Piano Concerto here at the Albert Hall on a Steinway piano, which has just been wheeled on stage. And as it did so, as Stephen was talking there, you missed the sound of the Prommers in the arena here at the Albert Hall with their traditional chant of heave-ho every time a piano is moved into the centre of the stage. It's now surrounded by members of the BBC Philharmonic, tonight's orchestra, in the first of tonight's two proms. Amazingly, they're cramming three symphonies into this first prom, and then later on tonight at 10:15, we're going to hear the Ivor Novello prom, Simon Callow and Toby Spence and Sophie Bevan as well, with the Halle and Sir Mark Eld. It promises to be a fantastic evening. Think of what we just heard, Delius's Cinera, as a kind of warm-up act. And that's applause for Yuri Turchinsky, holding his violin, leader of the BBC Philharmonic, and using his left hand to tune using that Steinway piano that Stephen Osborne's going to be playing. While the orchestra tunes up, let me tell you about Prom's poetry competition, which we're running at the moment. Ian McMillan, who's the resident wordsmith on Radio 3, is inviting everyone, young and old, to take inspiration from a piece of music in this year's prom season and write a poem about it. Perhaps something that you're hearing tonight is going to catch your attention. There are categories for both adults and children, and the winners will have their poems performed at a Proms Plus event and then broadcast here on Radio 3, which is, of course, the home of the BBC Proms. And you'll also be invited to come to a BBC Proms concert at the Royal Albert Hall. All of the details for that competition, including the terms and conditions, are online if you go to the Radio 3 website, bbc.co.uk/radio3, or the Proms website, bbc.co.uk/proms. And if poetry is your bag, then something to further inspire later on. Our interval feature is about Philip Larkin. But before that, we hear Stephen Osborne with the BBC Philharmonic in the Grieg Piano Concerto. Stephen Osborne coming on stage, shaking Yuri Turchinsky's hand and taking a bow before the audience here at the Royal Albert Hall.
Thank you. Thank you.
The pianist Stephen Osborne finishes playing the Grieg Piano Concerto, rapturous applause, and the first thing he does is to hug the conductor, John Sturgard, shake the hand of Yuri Turchynsky, the BBC Philharmonic's leader, and turn to the orchestra and clap them before he takes his own applause. A truly humble musician and a great one as well. He said earlier that he wasn't approaching the Grieg as an old warhorse that he had to breathe new life into, but that's exactly what he just did. He really lifted it above its familiar self. Stephen Osborne is a much loved, much respected artist here at the Proms. Former Radio 3 New Generation artist. Holding conductor John Sturgard's hand in the air as they bow together with the whole of the BBC Philharmonic standing behind them. It's wonderful to hear Stephen Osborne play a work as familiar as that. Repertoire that he's most associated with, as well as Debussy and Ravel and Rachmaninoff, is, I suppose, rather tricky pianistic repertoire like Alcan and Busoni. But whatever he does it with such commitment and artistry. Here comes Stephen Osborne by himself back to the stage, and I think we're going to get an encore.
Thank you.
Stephen Osborne playing there, in case you didn't hear him shout it out to the very grateful audience here who are often not quite sure what an encore is, Widmung by Robert Schumann, a song which translates as dedication from the beginning of his 24-song collection, Merton. And in fact, that's not the more familiar Liszt transcription of Schumann's Widmung. It was one by Stephen Osborne himself. Stephen Osborne, who's been pretty busy recently. He just did a solo concert of Ravel's piano music in Aldborough. He has a bit of a break now from the concert platform to start working on new repertoire that he's recording later on in the year. A couple of comments on Twitter about what we just heard. Grieg Piano Concerto says at Zille, must be such an amazing feeling to play that. Wow. And Hand Sent says, Mr. Grieg ably dispatched by Mr. Osborne there. Use the hashtag BBCProms if you want to get in touch on Twitter, and we'll pick up your message. Well, earlier on you heard me mention the Proms Poetry Competition. You can find all the details about that, including terms and conditions, online. And this should inspire you further. Our interval feature, Telling Me of Elsewhere, the historian Sean Street, with insights from Andrew Motion, exploring the importance of the radio to Philip Larkin and his poetry.
Had he lived, Philip Larkin would have been 90 today. He was born in 1922, the year the BBC's first radio station, 2LO, began broadcasting. What he would have made of today's media, downloads, the internet, listen again, and multiple channels, we can only guess at.
When he's having a grump about the interference that radio or wireless produces, he says, in a letter to somebody, no wonder Dickens and Trollope and Co. could write such enormous books if this bastard way of rotting the mind hadn't been thought up. But that's so typical of him, both in its locution and also in the way that he appears merely to resent it.
So it happens that I lie where Mr. Blini lay and stub my fegs on the same saucer souvenir and try stuffing my ears with cotton wool to drown the jabbering set he egged her on to buy.
Philip Larkin reading an extract from his poem, Mr. Blini, and before that, his friend and biographer, Andrew Motion, remembering a studiedly curmudgeonly character. Philip Larkin had a librarian's irritation at the intrusion of sound, noisy neighbours, traffic, often the radio, but equally he shared Thomas Hardy's fear of its absence and the implication of that absence. Waking at four to soundless dark.
I got to know Larkin 9 years before he died. And by the time I met him, two very important things had already happened. One is that he'd more or less stopped writing poems. And I think these things might be linked. And he'd also become very seriously deaf. So I think of Larkin as being a deaf person. He was also a person who'd had all kinds of other physical ailments. He wore quite thick glasses and so on and so forth. So he was very conscious of himself as somebody whose sensory engagement with the world did become, well, it diminished as he got older. And I think of those things, diminishments and depletions, probably the loss of hearing was the most serious for him. I remember him often talking about how melancholy, it made him feel that he couldn't hear birds singing anymore, for instance. The poems are very interestingly full of noises of one kind or another, and I suppose it's fair to say that often these noises concentrate around the image of somebody listening to a wireless. In Mr. Blini, the jabbering set.
And the fleeting nature of sound mirrored the passing of time, of relationships, of life itself. In 1955, he said, I write poems to preserve things I've seen, thought, felt, both for myself and for others, though I feel that my prime responsibility is to the experience itself, which I'm trying to keep from oblivion, for its own sake. Like the small, blunt footprints in the snow outside his house, left by his lover, Maeve Brennan, before they vanished in the morning rain, in his poem, Morning at Last, There in the Snow. Like radio signals carried away on the air. Implicit in so much of his poetry is an England bleak with post-war austerity and the radio's ultralight, its glowing wave bands, the memory of a medium that brought him his early experiences of jazz. In the 30s, it was a fugitive minority interest, he wrote, a record heard by chance from a foreign station. The sounds of King Oliver, Louis Armstrong, Sidney Bechet.
That note you hold, narrowing and rising, shakes like New Orleans reflected on the water, and in all ears appropriate falsehood wakes, building for some a legendary quarter of balconies, flower baskets and quadrilles, everyone making love and going shares. Oh, play that thing! Mute, glorious Storyvilles others may license, grouping round their chairs sporting house girls like circus tigers priced far above rubies to pretend their fads, while scholars manqués nod around unnoticed, wrapped up in personnels like old plaids. On me your voice falls, as they say love should, like an enormous yes. My crescent city is where your speech alone is understood and greeted as the natural noise of good, scattering long-haired grief and scored pity.
Bechet's Blue Horizon, which was played at Larkin's memorial service in Westminster Abbey in early 1986. That recording of Larkin reading his poem for Sidney Bechet comes from a series of tapes made, reportedly, after lunch in Hull with his friend, the sound engineer John Weeks, on February Sundays in 1980. Predictably, Philip Larkin had strong views about spoken poetry. Many poets are paranoid bores, and those impure assemblages known as poetry readings are a wonderful new way of being paranoically boring. As my first axiom, I should lay down that the only desirable form of spoken modern poetry is that which whispers in the corner, or corners these days, in hi-fi. His antiquarian rage boiled at the thought of the legions of pre-1928 tenors and sopranos we preserved when nobody thought to record, say, Hardy or Lawrence. I suspect that the radio Larkin most hated was that peripheral sound that was heard but not listened to, the background muzak and chatter that grew more and more ubiquitous during his lifetime, the jabber he refers to in Mr. Blini. His imaginative encounter with someone who is almost an alter ego is, as Andrew Motion suggests, a crucial part of his art, the grit in the oyster.
Mr. Blini is a poem that he wrote soon after arriving in Hull when he was living in Diggs, that had previously been lived in by Mr. Blini, who had sort of left his mark here, there and everywhere in the whole house, actually, because Mr. Blini, had become quite pally with the landlady and had persuaded her to buy this jabbering set. And the poem really is about the resemblance between himself, the narrator of the poem, and this precursor. They're joined at the end of the poem by Larkin saying that perhaps if he was sort of more or less my age and he'd done no better in life than to have this hired box, which is the room that he's taking, how miserable that is. But for all its melancholy and self-accusation, I think one that's lifted very interestingly by an extremely beautifully structured long last sentence, which kind of winds and coils. And even though that last line is a kind of depressed bafflement, nevertheless, the strategy that he uses to deliver it, I've always found a curiously uplifting one.
Mr. Blini. This was Mr. Blini's room. He stayed the whole time he was at the bodies, till they moved him. Flowered curtains, thin and frayed, fall to within 5 inches of the sill, whose window shows a strip of building land, tussocky, littered. Mr. Blaney took my bit of garden properly in hand. Bed, upright chair, 60-watt bulb, no hook behind the door, no room for books or bags. I'll take it. I know his habits, what time he came down, his preference for sauce to gravy, why he kept on plugging at the four aways. Likewise, their yearly frame, the Frinton folk who put him up for summer holidays and Christmas at his sister's house in Stoke. But if he stood and watched the frigid wind tousling the clouds, lay on the fusty bed, telling himself that this was home, and grinned and shivered, without shaking off the dread that how we live measures our own nature, and at his age, having no more to show than one hired box should make him pretty sure he warranted no better, I don't know.
On the other hand, Larkin can celebrate lives outside that tawdry room, and how sometimes radio takes us beyond our limits, elsewhere, but in our own space.
The second part of his three-part poem, Livings, has a very beautiful glance at radio noise, wireless noise. Radio rubs its legs, telling me of elsewhere. Elsewhere is a crucial word for him. And it allows us to begin to say, I think, that the range of responses that he covers when he's talking about wireless or radio, whatever you want to call it, is very interestingly wide. Sometimes he's being driven bonkers by the noise coming out of it, because it's stopping him thinking about something else, and particularly stopping him thinking about writing poems, because he sort of either feels interrupted by somebody else's radio, or he hasn't got the gumption to turn off his own. And at other times he feels very thrillingly, as in the second of those Livings poems, thrillingly connected with an idea of elsewhere, such an important word for him, the importance of elsewhere. It's, of course, the title of one of his short poems. And it allows him two things. It allows him, as radio generally does, a kind of intimacy of connection with, without feeling that he's personally involved in it. I'm going to read the second part of this three-part poem called Livings, in which, in a rather novelish way, he takes three types of person, three forms of being employed, and talks about the conditions of their lives. And on the face of it, all these people are very different. There's a man who deals with farmers, some kind of travelling salesman person in the first part. There's a lighthouse keeper in the second part, the part I'm going to read. And in the third part, there's a sort of rather stereotypical Oxbridge don fussing around at a high table, talking eruditely about rather peculiar things. They appear to be very different from one another, but where they meet is in an idea about solitude, how you accommodate solitude in a life that might be full of conversation, how you are frightened by it in some respects, and how in other respects you deeply enjoy it. And that's nowhere more manifest than it is in this second part, which has a kind of intensity, colour, concentration, an unconversational quality to it that is interestingly untypical of him, I think. 70 feet down, the sea explodes upwards, relapsing to slaver off landing stage steps. Running suds rejoice. Rocks writhe back to sight. Muscles, limpets, husband their tenacity in the freezing slither. Creatures, I cherish you. By day, sky builds grape dark over the salt, unsown, stirring fields. Radio rubs its legs, telling me of elsewhere. Barometers falling, ports wind-shuttered, fleets pent like hounds, fires in humped inns, kippering sea pictures. Keep it all off. By night, snow swerves, O loose moth world, through the stair travelling leather-black waters. Guarded by brilliance, I set plate and spoon, and after divining cards, lit shelved liners, grope like mad worlds westward. I'm not sure who that sounds like, really, but it doesn't really sound like Larkin, or what we think of Larkin as sort of most characteristically being like. So it's a poem which very interestingly manifests the variety that is there, I think, in his work. But at the centre of it is this idea of the solitary life, the life dedicated to self-scrutiny, enjoyment of the natural world, which is sort of clearly there in the figure of the lighthouse keeper himself, who, and this is the paradox, has the radio on to stay in touch with, to be made aware of barometers falling, ports wind shuttered, and so on and so on, that little catalogue in the middle of the poem. And if he really didn't want to know about that, he'd turn the radio off, but he keeps the radio on, and then, once he's made those connections, ends that catalogue by saying, keep it all off. So there you have the balance between things. Come hither, go away. That's what's going on in the poem, I think. And I think Larkin enjoyed that mixture of things very deeply. I think he loved being in touch with things. He loved to know what was going on. And I'm thinking in the widest possible terms as I say that, socially, politically, culturally. But he didn't really want it to trammel him. So radio provides the connection, but it also allows for the separation. That's the perfect balance for him, I think.
They watched the landscape, sitting side by side. An Odeon went past, a cooling tower, and someone running up to bowl. And none thought of the others they would never meet, or how their lives would all contain this hour.
Time and life passing, other places, elsewhere. The images caught from the train in the Whitsun weddings, temporal visual signals caught verbally, kept from oblivion for their own sake, transmitted and then absorbed by interior silence, set against the noise the weddings make, an uncle shouting smut, and behind it all, shuffling gouts of steam, present but mostly implicit, the noise of a railway journey.
And as we raced across bright knots of rail past standing pullmans, walls of blackened moss came close, and it was nearly done, this frail travelling coincidence. And what it held stood ready to be loosed with all the power that being changed can give. We slowed again, and as the tightened brakes took hold, there swelled a sense of falling, like an arrow shower sent out of sight, somewhere becoming rain.
When you start to think about it, and it's something that is rather important to start to think about, I think, we realise that there are really a lot of Larkin poems that are to do with hearing in one way or another. And another of the poems that is about listening is this poem called Reference Back, which he wrote remembering a visit that he made to his mum and playing old jazz records.
That was a pretty one. I heard you call from the unsatisfactory hall to the unsatisfactory room where I played record after record, idly, wasting my time at home that you looked so much forward to. Oliver's Riverside Blues, it was. And now I shall, I suppose, always remember how the flock of notes those antique Negroes blew out of Chicago air into a huge, remembering, pre-electric horn the year after I was born, 3 decades later, made this sudden bridge from your unsatisfactory age to my unsatisfactory prime.
I think Reference Back is one of Larkin's very, very best poems, and I think that extraordinary last verse is something that Wordsworth would have been proud to see that he'd written in the prelude. It has that kind of grand philosophical utterance, and to make room for that and to get there so fast in a poem of this length is really extraordinary, I think. I think it's very telling that it depends on an act of listening. It's not precisely to do with radio, but it is to do with the auditory imagination.
The next poem broadcast seems to be about as near as I get in this collection to a love poem. It's not, I'm afraid, very near.
The fleeting signals and the pictures they suggest come into focus in another poem about Maeve Brennan, written in 1961, a poem thoroughly fitting to hear Larkin read before we return to this evening's concert. In Broadcast, he is himself listening to the radio, to a live transmission of a concert. For Andrew Motion, it's a poignant poem, full of the separation and yet connection between Larkin and Maeve, knowing she's there, an anonymous part of the audience, somewhere in that distant hall.
Broadcast is the poem of his that, as it were, has most to say about the radio and the sort of connections that radio can make. I think it is a poem of tremendous tenderness, I must say. So even if it isn't quite a 100% love poem, it's certainly a very tender poem. But once again, it's a poem which both regrets the lack of actual involvement with the person being commemorated in the poem, but at the same time relishes that distance. It enjoys the imaginative purchase which he's able to have by not being involved in the scene in a more direct way.
Giant whispering and coughing from vast sandy full and organ frowned on spaces precede a sudden scuttle on the drum, the queen and huge resettling. Then begins a snivel on the violins. I think of your face among all those faces, beautiful and devout before cascades of monumental slithering, one of your gloves unnoticed on the floor beside those new, slightly outmoded shoes. Here it goes quickly dark. I lose all but the outline of the still and withering leaves on half-empty trees. Behind the glowing wave bends, rabid storms of cording, by being distant, overpower my mind all the more shamelessly. Their cut-off shout, leaving me desperate to pick out your hands, tiny in all that air, applauding.
Philip Larkin reading his poem Broadcast. Telling Me of Elsewhere, Philip Larkin and the Radio was presented by Sean Street and produced by Julian May. Well, if you, like Philip Larkin, are listening to this BBC Prom live here on BBC Radio 3 tonight and are inspired to write a poem about some of the music you're hearing, then do enter the Prom's poetry competition. There are complete details and also terms and conditions online. And if you can condense what you have to say about the music into 140 characters and want to join the conversation on Twitter, make sure you use the hashtag BBCProms. Plenty of messages coming in, like Matthew Lynch on Twitter, who says, Stephen Osborne, stunning in all respects. What a superb encore. Stephen Osborne played the Grieg Piano Concerto and then went on to play his own arrangement of Schumann's Widmung, which some of you were asking about. Well, the second half of the first of tonight's two proms contains two symphonies, another from Sibelius, his third, and first of all, the UK premiere of the Seventh Symphony from Per Nørgaard. Now, after the prom, you'll be able to hear more about his music from Ivan Hewitt and Andrew McGregor. It's interesting to hear Per Nørgaard's music alongside Sibelius, because according to tonight's conductor, John Sturgaard, Sibelius has been quite a big influence on him. And he also suggested to me that Nørgaard is following a similar journey in his symphonies as the Finnish master, in the sense that each symphony inhabits a new world. It does something different. Nørgaard, in fact, currently working on and close to completing his Eighth Symphony, which John Sturgaard is due to conduct the first performance of. The Seventh, that we're about to hear the BBC Philharmonic play, was finished in 2009. He wrote it for the grand opening of the new home of the Danish Radio Symphony Orchestra, the Koncerthuset in Copenhagen. It's that impressive glass and light-filled building that juts out towards the water. The opening, somehow reminiscent of Sibelius, a huge sweep of crystalline sound, and then the rhythm takes over. Per Nørgaard Symphony No. 7 gets its UK premiere now at the Proms.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Danish composer Per Nørgaard's Seventh Symphony getting its UK premiere live here at the BBC Proms. The BBC Philharmonic, conducted by their principal guest conductor, John Sturgard. Totally engrossed in Per Nørgaard's Symphony No. 7, mesmerising, said Alice Bolton on Twitter. A couple of your other reactions to that. Liking this symphony from Nørgaard in the BBC Proms, says Stephen, but would like tips on how to pronounce him properly. Well, Per Nørgaard is about the best that I can do. If you can do better than that, do let me know. Using the hashtag BBC Proms on Twitter. The whole BBC Philharmonic on their feet now, with their leader Yuri Tuchinsky and the conductor, John Sturgard, who's shortly to conduct the premiere of Per Nørgaard's Eighth Symphony, which is on its way. Well, there's more of Per Nørgaard's music later in a Proms composer portrait with Andrew McGregor in conversation with Ivan Hewitt. That's coming up after the end of this concert and before the start of tonight's late night prom, in which we're delving into the sound world completely different to this one of Ivor Novello. Well, Per Nørgaard much admired Sibelius. I had a lovely story from Andrew McGregor earlier on today about a teenage Nørgaard who was listening to the radio and he heard Sibelius's Second Symphony and he was so blown away by it that he wrote to Sibelius and he also sent him his Opus 1 and apparently Sibelius wrote back to him. The two of them never actually met, although they were once in a room, but Per Nørgaard was far too scared to go up and talk to Sibelius. Well, the programme ends with Sibelius, his Third Symphony, and to tell us a bit about it, here's tonight's conductor, John Sturgard.
The Third, I think, is really something new for its time, and very little related to what he had done symphonically before that. A work full of surprises, I guess, for the listener who doesn't know it still. And also, it's a very adventurous, exciting process. Even if the main key is C major, and somebody could expect that, how can you make something exciting and interesting and wild of so much C major? But he really does. And also, I think some of the most modern music he ever wrote is in the Third Symphony. There are some really wild kind of modern elements in that piece, especially in the beginning of the last movement, which he also said himself that this has to be like chaos, and then little by little going into the final C major euphoria. From that on, he was really not the same Sibelius as he was before.
Tonight's conductor here at the BBC Proms, John Sturgard, who's the chief principal guest conductor of the BBC Philharmonic. He's been working with them for about a year. It's his first appearance with them at the BBC Proms. Well, he's talking about the piece that we're going to hear next, Sibelius's Third Symphony. Tom Service has done a Proms music guide about the piece as well, which you can download from the Proms and Radio 3 websites. Just go to bbc.co.uk/radio3, follow the links to podcasts. In that, Tom Service describes the final movement in terms of Einstein's theory of relativity. The faster you go, the slower you get, essentially. It is an extraordinary crescendo to a rather extraordinary work. Well, the orchestra and John Sturgard are going to be flying off to Lapland tomorrow. They're going on a bit of a Finnish tour. And they're going to be playing football against John Sturgard's own orchestra, the Lapland Chamber Orchestra. He apparently is going to be in goal for the Lapland Chamber Orchestra. Before that, though, he's making his way onto the stage of the Albert Hall to the podium, perhaps a slightly safer spot for him, to conduct Sibelius's Symphony No. 3.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Triumphant, and also a depiction of chaos in Sibelius's own words. His third symphony, performed live here at the BBC Proms by the BBC Philharmonic, conducted by their principal guest conductor, John Sturgard, the Finnish conductor. Playing to a packed Royal Albert Hall here. They've managed to pack three symphonies into the first of tonight's two proms. Pretty impressive stuff. As I mentioned earlier, they're off on tour now to Lapland. Meanwhile, the Halle Orchestra is backstage preparing for the late night prom tonight, the Ivor Novello celebrations, joined by soprano Sophie Bevan, tenor Toby Spence, and Simon Callow. John Sturgard's returning to the stage now, applauding the BBC Philharmonic and bringing them to their feet, but they refuse in his honour. And now they rise to their feet with him. Well, it's been very much a Nordic night here at the Proms so far. For Usain Bolt winning gold in the 200 metres, it's been, I think, a rather glorious night. And it's about to become a glamorous night at 10:15 with the start of the Ivor Novello Prom. Before that, we've a chance to hear more music by the Danish composer Per Nørgaard, whose Seventh Symphony we just heard. For that, I'm going to hand you on to James Jolly in Broadcasting House. Good night.
Thanks, Sarah. That was Sarah Moore-Peach. And there's another chance to hear that prom on Tuesday week, the 21st of August at 2 o'clock here on BBC Radio 3. As Sarah said, we return to the Royal Albert Hall for our next prom at 10:15. And before that, at 9:30, we've our prom's composer portrait.
Life for young Europeans.
If you are caught sleeping in a public place, then you can be fined or you can go to prison. Basically, poverty is criminalized if you're homeless.
A generation fighting draconian legislation, rising poverty, and corruption.
He's young, he's inexperienced, but that's a good thing because he's inexperienced in politics, he doesn't know how to steal.
BBC Radio 4 spends a week with Generation E, starting next Monday at 1:45.
Well, we've a little time in hand, or a moment or two in her time in hand, before the proms composer portrait. So I thought we'd stay in Northern Europe for a piano miniature, a lyric piece by Grieg. Here's Andrei Gavrilov. Summer's Eve by Grieg, played by Andrei Gavrilov. This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. Now it's 9:30 and we've our proms composer portrait recorded earlier at the Royal College of Music. Here's Andrew McGregor.
Welcome to the Concert Hall of the Royal College of Music. We're going to be discovering a great deal more about the man behind the Seventh Symphony, given its UK premiere in this evening's prom, Danish composer Pierre Nørgaard. Now, usually I'd be sitting here with the composer himself. That's how these portraits work. But we know that there's a degree of optimism involved in asking Pierre to join us today. He just turned 80, and his age and rheumatism make it increasingly difficult to leave home for this kind of celebration of his music. He's sorry he couldn't join us himself, but writer, broadcaster, and contemporary music enthusiast Ivan Hewitt is here with me, and so are the students from the Royal Northern College of Music who've been preparing Nørgaard's Dances Around Jupiter and his sixth quartet, Tintinnabulary, for us to hear. So it may be a little less of a self-portrait than we normally have, but there's no reason why we shouldn't achieve a good likeness. Now, Ivan, you've met Pierre Nørgaard several times. Give us an idea of what the man's like physically to meet him. How does he come across?
Well, he's very tall, for one thing. You have to look up to Pierre in more than one sense. And he's like a sort of tall Viking, really. You know, he's very blonde. There's a short story of D.H. Lawrence where Lawrence talks about a character as being like a piece of the outdoors come indoors. And that's what Pierre Nørgaard is like. You know, you'd imagine him in his seven-league boots striding over a Danish hill somewhere. And he's also very charming and extraordinarily courteous. That's the other thing about the man. He's got this old-world courtesy, which we will, in fact, hear later.
And I read about Pierre in his early years as a child and as a student being rather shy and a little withdrawn, which seems to be characteristics which came through as he developed as a composer. Is that still something you're aware of when you meet him?
Well, he's somebody who lives very much in his own world. Shy, I think, wouldn't be quite the right word now, but certainly very self-contained. It's very hard to imagine Pierre Nogor doing anything for publicity's sake, you know. A feature of his childhood was that he was very interested in theatre. He used to build little theatres and make little models of characters and invent fantastical dramatic scenes, rather like Ligeti, actually. And it took him a while to discover that music was going to be his real talent.
Because he'd make mini musicals, wouldn't he, and draw cartoons for them as
well. He would. He was very ambitious as a child. You know, it would be the complete show he'd present, you know. And, of course, he has kept his flair for music theatre since. You know, there are operas and music theatre pieces in his catalogue.
And what about early musical background? Because I suppose, well, growing up in Denmark from the 30s through to the 50s, he was musically Scandinavian first, wasn't he, or Nordic, rather than European by instinct?
Yeah, absolutely, yes. He has always said that he's a great admirer of Carl Nielsen, particularly, and the most eminent follower also of Carl Nielsen, who was a man called Wagner Holmboe, who Nielsen studied with. Nogor himself describes his music of those days, the 50s, as completely wild, and he was amazed that Wagner Holmboe took him on. But he did, and in fact became his favoured pupil, in fact, and Nogor was called upon to finish unfinished works of Holmboe. And his early works do show a kind of Sibelius-like fascination with musical processes which are organic and unending and don't seem to aim at an emphatic end point and have a suggestion of illimitable horizons and a strange kind of... I know it sounds a slightly cliché thing to say, but they do have a kind of Nordic light to them, you know, a kind of cool intensity.
It's interesting hearing you say that, because I read him... I'm disagreeing with the idea that Sibelius is in some way about nature, the way he writes music. I mean, what did he say? It's that the music works in the same way that nature does, but it's not actually about nature.
Yes, now that's a very interesting distinction. I think Nogor is... somewhat like John Cage, interestingly, with whom he has nothing else in common, really, in the sense that he's not interested in how nature looks and sounds. You know, he's not interested in making attractive portraits of landscapes, for example. What fascinates him is the mechanisms that underlie the visual appearance of nature, like mathematical processes, like the processes of growth. He's... really in love with self-generating processes like the Fibonacci series of numbers, you know, which multiplies itself endlessly. And he's interested in nature from the molecular level to the cosmic, I think it's true to say. It's not just the landscape that interests him, it's the wheeling of the spheres and down to the molecular level.
And we are certainly going to be hearing elements of that in the two chamber works we have. And it's interesting hearing what Nogor himself picks up on to talk about in his own music, because we will be hearing from him as part of this composer portrait, because he recorded some reflections on the way his Seventh Symphony works, especially for us, and he made these recordings only yesterday so that we could hear them ourselves. Here he is, just for us.
Hello. It's a pleasure for me... to give a very short introduction to my Seventh Symphony, which is very characterized in the first movement by small drums, 14 in number, going downwards like this: boom, 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 beep, beep, boom, boom. Having this bright character, I was very fascinated of the uncertainty of when does the next boom come. And that is into the contrast of second movement very simple little melody. And then suddenly interrupted by an enormous C major chord. It's like all the movement has this very forceful start and then it's dying out. Last movement goes on, in fact, where first movement ended, as if we have cut some part of the first movement, ending noch einmal, as the German says, we would say, still you would hear this boom, 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 and that finishes the work. Thank you for your attention.
It's almost as if he was here with us, isn't
Indeed.
It?
Indeed. What a shame.
Pierre Nogal sending us some reflections on the Seventh Symphony, given its UK premiere in this evening's prompt. So, Ivan, how much are we going to hear of those kinds of elements in the chamber music that's ahead of us? Rhythmically, there's some very interesting things happening.
There are, indeed. I mean, I should say first, we'll hear quite a lot of C major, in fact, because both pieces are somewhat obsessed with it. They keep returning to it. And when you hear that bottom C, of course, in the string quartet, it's a bottom C string, so it has a nice resonant twang to it. In the saxophone quartet, it makes a pretty good fruity noise as well, I must say. And one feels it as a kind of tonal center, but not in the sense of a grammatically tonal center. It feels almost as if the music is rooted in it in the way that... a natural phenomenon is rooted in its fundamental vibration. I suppose that's the metaphor to conjure it. You asked about the rhythm. There is certainly quite a strong reminiscence of that little drum, descending drum figure in the quartet. It seems to be a characteristic of his more recent music that he wants to conjure up. I mean, the way I read it is that he's looking for a horizontal equivalent, a temporal expression, of the kind of non-harmonic, the kind of irregular partials, upper partials, that you hear in things like bell sounds. And, of course, that quartet is called Tintinabulary, and it is very obsessed with bells.
Well, we don't get an explicit program for the work. You wouldn't expect it with Pierre Nogal, would you?
Absolutely not.
But he does write something to introduce the score. He says the bell-like association of the title reflects the special texture of the work, like the changing overtones of a struck, resonating bell. The four instruments are unified in a single line, which is broken up in a multitude of changing dynamics and rhythmic patterns. And we have lots of those harmonics ringing against each other, don't we? And the rhythmic layers are fascinating as well, layer upon layer, and changes of speed, doublings, quadruplings of speed.
Yes, on the page it looks pretty fearsome. To listen to it, I think it's not so fearsome. And the reason for that, I think the thing that separates Nogal from people who share some of these interests, like Stockhausen, for example, is that Nogal never loses his attachment to things which are rooted in music's culture. And I think he's interested in bringing together things which come out of the natural world, like these sequences of non-harmonic partials, with things that are very reminiscent of the human musical world. And so, for example, there's a I think quite a funny moment in this quartet where a tangle of descending lines, which itself prompts the rooted sea to skitter about in a slightly schizo-like way, is suddenly brought to an abrupt halt by what sounds like a really old-fashioned perfect cadence. It's, you know, like the kind of cadence you get at the end of a hymn, you know, da-dum. And it happens at top speed, and it's just thrown into the texture so fast that you could miss it. And it's a kind of little joke, I think. And there are little jokes dropped into the music quite often.
Well, let's hear it. To perform Pierre Nergal's Tintinnabulary, his sixth string quartet, please welcome our four string players from the Royal Northern College of Music in Manchester. Violinists Chi Yen Wu and Edward Brenton, viola player Matthew Kettle, and cellist Joe Zeitlin.